with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering a research-based master's degree in biological sciences, covering diverse topics from ecology to molecular biology. With a 90% placement rate, become a leader in a science field that is shaping the future. Details online at uwp.edu. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
As longtime listeners to The Morning Show know by now, I love speaking to documentarians, those responsible for great illuminating films. And I'm excited for the next few minutes to have the opportunity to speak with Mike, who is one of the people responsible for a breathtaking film, breathtaking in its beauty, and also in a sense breathtaking in the importance of its message. The film is titled Meltdown. It's a superb work of art, but beyond that, also an urgent call for concern around the issue of climate change and specifically global warming. And Mike Tolan has been behind a number of important documentaries that I'm sure you have heard of, including the marvelous film The Last Dance, that series really devoted to Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls, and also Hank Aaron, Chasing the Dream. This newest film, Meltdown, which has just been released, is available on iTunes and on demand through Amazon and Google Play and so on. And we have Mike Tolan, its executive producer, for the next few minutes to talk about Meltdown and what prompted him to want to help get this film made. Mike Tolan, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Good morning. It's nice to be here with you.
I hope you won't mind just ahead of us talking about Meltdown if we talk for a moment about the film Hank Aaron Chasing the Dream, since the world lost Hank Aaron on the 22nd of January. Would you mind just sharing a brief reminiscence about what it was like to help create that film about this baseball legend?
No, not at all. The only challenge will be getting me to stop talking about the goodness of the experience and the greatness of the man, Hank Aaron. This is more than a quarter century ago that we made Chasing the Dream. It was nominated for an Oscar and won a Peabody, and it remains, I guess, my proudest moment in filmmaking, not for the ratings or the box office, but for the impact at the conclusion of the film being released on Turner Broadcasting. Ted Turner, as we urged him, reached into the other pocket and found money to endow a foundation, the same name, Chasing the Dream. And in the 25 plus years, we've been able to grant scholarships to inner city underserved kids to chase their own dreams. It was Henry Aaron's goal to have kids be given the opportunity, like he was given the opportunity to pursue his baseball dream. And this was not about baseball or even sports. It was whatever it was that got a child excited and gave them a sense of identity. So music and dance and literature, and we've given scholarships to hundreds of kids and endowed millions of dollars. And that, I think, is Henry would have said in his last years that was something he was more proud of than the 755 home runs. So one of the great joys, pleasures and privileges of my life to become friends with Henry Aaron and participate in some small way.
A great, great man, and it's a great film about him, and I heartily encourage anybody who has not yet seen it to, or if you've seen it, to see it again, Hank Aaron, Chasing the Dream. And I do congratulate you as well on The Last Dance, a much lauded work about Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls and their incredible run of world championships. It would seem, at least at a glance, that it is a huge chasm between films like that and this film that we are talking about today, Meltdown, which confronts the issue of global warming. Is there a connection that we are missing, or is it the leap that it appears to be?
Well, it's a fair enough assessment. Not so far from Milwaukee and Atlanta to Chicago, much farther from Chicago to Alulisat, a sleepy little hamlet of roughly 5,000 people on the west coast of Greenland. The origin story is a little bit bizarre, which makes it kind of fun to retell. It was really more about interior decorating than climate change, to be honest. I have a New York apartment, and a friend named David Rawl, an art collector, was in a oblique sort of way suggesting that the walls were a little bare and I could spruce it up, and did I have any particular taste that he could tap into? And I said, you know, I love black and white landscape photography. And he said, boy, do I have an artist for you, Lynn Davis. I suggest that to any of your listeners. You can Google Ms. Davis, who's now into her 70s but remains vibrant and robust in her output. She had gone to Greenland 6 or 7 times in the previous 3 decades and has made quite a career out of shooting the icebergs in the Arctic Circle off the coast of Alulisat. And I began investigating, and David Rawl put me in touch with Lynn personally. She lives in Hudson, New York. I went to see her photos at the Edwin Hauck Gallery on Fifth Avenue in New York City, and I became enamored, as he expected I would, and we struck up a friendship, and I talked to Lynn about going back to Alulisat one last time. I said, you know, your work is particularly timely. I mean, you are a climate change chronicler. And she said, ah, I don't know anything about all that. I'm just a photographer. I'm just an artist. Lynn shoots with a Rolleiflex, a single lens, and rolls film in the old-fashioned way that we all used to, 12 exposures per roll. And then she makes her own photos in the dark room, and they're just magical. Anyway, she protested loudly, I don't know anything about climate change, and I said, well, wouldn't it be fun to go back there now in 2016, as it was, and investigate and look at how the melting glaciers in Greenland have impacted us around the world. It is often considered ground zero by climate change experts. And she was up for the challenge, and we found a wonderful and learned man named Anthony Lazarowitz, who runs the climate change program at Yale. And off we went. And so it really became a journey to look at how beauty and tragedy can coexist and how we can investigate such a hot-button issue from two very divergent points of view.
Yes. One of the most interesting moments in the film is when we see the small plane in which Lynn Davis is riding approaching what I assume is the landing strip there at Alulisat, Greenland. And she is looking out the window, and she's looking at the ice below her. And she, even at a glance, can tell the difference in terms of the ice that is there and its shape versus what it once was. And we can, in a sense, see that ourselves, because the images are captured with such breathtaking clarity. But she has been there before, unlike us, and she sees with her own eyes the alarming change. Tell us more about that.
Well, Lynn talks about going to Alulisat originally because of loss. In the 80s, Lynn was part of a downtown New York City troupe of photographers, Robert Mapplethorpe being the most well-known among them. And she was shooting primarily portraits, with a gaggle of guys who were her compatriots, and one by one they died off due to the AIDS crisis. And she was feeling this enormous sense of loss and eager to get as far away as possible. And her husband, who's a filmmaker in his own right, Rudy Wurlitzer, saw some photos of these icebergs off the coast of Greenland and said to her, "They remind me of the nudes you shoot. There's something about the architecture. There's something about the imagery." And she said, "How far away is it?" And it really is about as far as you could go, and as remote. And I'm sure back then in the 80s it was more difficult to get to. And so off she went. And as she said, the origins of her first journey were really about loss. And then, as viewers will learn if they watch the film, it becomes about a deep and personal loss, which is revealed toward the end of the film. But as she's looking out the window, as you point out, she said, "This was all about loss on a personal basis, but I never thought it would be about loss of the planet." And she realizes what's happening because she had actually done some research and understood the connection between the melting glaciers and all that was happening around the world. So it took on a whole different meaning.
Mm. Before you began making this film, what kind of background did you personally have when it comes to climate change and global warming? How much did you end up learning through the course of making this film?
Well, the answer to the first question, quite frankly, is very little, which is why it was so exciting. As you pointed out, a great deal of my documentary work, as well as my scripted narrative feature film work, has focused in and around sports themes and stories. We love telling stories with sports as a backdrop. I've always felt it was a great spine. It was a great narrative. You kind of know what's at stake. You know the good guys. You know what you're rooting for. And it's always struck me as a universal language. Sports is a great connector. It builds communities. And most of our sports films, we'd like to say, are about something much more than who wins or loses. But it's a great access point for an audience. As I'd already described, came in an odd, unlikely sort of way, and it just struck me as a great opportunity for discovery for me on a personal basis. I claim no real knowledge other than, you know, reading a couple of newspapers on a daily basis and being somewhat aware of this crisis. In fact, what was great about finding Tony Lazarowicz as our partner for Lynn is that he's a social scientist, so it's not as much about statistics and all the numbers and all the, you know, percentages of the decrease in the size of the glacier and the rising tides and so forth. It's more for Tony about people's attitudes and awareness. So this was a great journey for me to kind of examine my own thoughts. How alarmed am I about this encroaching crisis? How aware am I of the danger it presents to all of us? And so I really, you know, I went on this journey not just to make a film along with director Fred Golding, but also to, you know, discover my own feelings about it. And it's interesting when we talk about this different approach. I've had a lot of conversations with other climate change experts along the way, and I love when people talk about the complexity of the issues and how, you know, it's not really an economic or a political issue, but it's, as it's been said by people who are much more steeped in it, it's really a value-driven spiritual question about who we are on the planet and what our responsibilities are.
I really do appreciate that the film balances a number of different elements, including hard, fast information, much of which is alarming, with the breathtaking beauty of these landscapes. Among the information shared with us from Tony Lazarowicz is the reality that the far north of our globe, Greenland, is warming more quickly than the rest of the globe. And the ramifications of that are truly staggering. But what's also interesting, and it points to what you were just saying about Professor Lazarowicz also being a social scientist, is he understands the importance of hope, and that we are more likely to connect with the public and galvanize action if we can present real hope for these alarming trends to be somehow reversed or curbed. That if there is no hope, then there's no reason, in a sense, to be alarmed in the first place, or certainly no reason to try to do anything about it. Can you just say a word about the word of hope that is important to Professor Lazarowicz and important in terms of your film?
Well, maybe you've just actually drawn a connection for me that I wasn't aware of, because there's nothing more important about sports than hope, right? Hope springs eternal. It's what we all say in March as our baseball players trot off to spring training and our woebegone team strikes out with hopes anew for a pennant season. You're from Milwaukee. you know what it's like. It hasn't happened that often since the 1957 Braves, mm-hmm. carried to the World Series championship by Hank Aaron. But yes, the beauty of Tony is, no matter how alarming the statistics and how much reversal there was in the last 4 years due to the administration's refusal to acknowledge science, he always has been hopeful. He's just a cheery, positive guy who believes ultimately in humanity and our ability to see through whatever crisis it is. So I think now, as of January 20, we've seen immediate reversals, and this administration has made climate change a priority. So he's very hopeful. I talked to Tom Steyer, a leading environmentalist who's watched the film and has really been a great, just an advocate along the way. And he's very hopeful and believes that, this is interesting, this is going to be, in Tom's opinion, the century of women, and women are increasingly going to be in positions of power, and they're increasingly going to be having to deal with contraception and family planning, and birth rates are likely to decrease somewhat as a result of that, and our increasing awareness of the crisis of overpopulation. And he looks at that as one of the great forces in our favor, because as the planet gets overcrowded, as we go from 7 billion people, you know, towards 10 or 11 billion, the problems intensify. This is the complexity we talk about. So many factors enter into it. But really, it's incredible to see how in just a few weeks' time, hope has returned to the populace at large in this country. And I wish President Biden and his staff great luck in leading us in the right direction.
Your film is a wonder to behold, beautiful in so many respects, and also a deeply personal film that, among other things, takes us into the life of Lynn Davis and to some of the heartbreaking loss that she has experienced, and also the passion with which she has done her work over the years. And, of course, her own personal odyssey as she returns to Greenland is especially moving. The film, again, is titled Meltdown, and it is now available through iTunes or wherever you stream films on demand, and it is well worth exploring and experiencing. Directed by Frederick Golding, and executive producer for it, Mike Tolan. Mike Tolan, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show and for speaking so eloquently on behalf of this marvelous film.
Thanks so much. Enjoy the time.
What does it mean to be tough? What is toughness? Is there a difference between physical toughness and mental toughness? Is there a difference between being tough and acting tough? Is tough a quality that is more masculine than feminine? What does it take to be tough in the face of life's adversity? These are just some of the intriguing questions that are explored in a really great new book, which is called Tough: building true mental, physical, and emotional toughness for success and fulfillment. The author of the book is Greg Everett, who is primarily a weightlifting coach up to and including the world championship level, and he himself was a nationally competitive lifter. But he has engaged in a lot of other vocations and activities over his life, and it's not just in the athletic arena, but in some of these other endeavors as well, that he has come to a new understanding of what real toughness is, and has written a book that was much more thoughtful than I expected it to be quite honest. I'm very impressed with the thought that he has given to this intriguing question and to this very impressively written book, which explores various aspects of toughness and gives the readers some suggestions on how to foster better toughness within themselves. Again, the book is titled Tough, Building True Mental, Physical, and Emotional Toughness for Success and Fulfillment. And Greg Everett, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I really did enjoy the book, and again, enjoyed it even more than I expected I would. I guess it's partly because I have read an awful lot of these kind of books in the course of my work on this radio program over the years, and some books are written better than others, and I think your book is very, very well read, written, and very thoughtfully crafted. You mention at some point in passing that you actually first began collecting some notes for such a book 10 years ago in 2011, but that this book is a very different book from the one that you would have written had you written it all those years ago. Explain, first of all, what was sort of behind your first efforts at putting a book together and in what ways this book is different than that first book would have been, or earlier book would have been.
Yeah, I think that, you know, those early notes, the early idea was certainly more leaning toward the physical aspects of toughness. And, you know, at that point I was, you know, the majority of my writing for the past 10 years has been more of the technical and athletic nature because that is my primary career. So it was certainly more towards that side of things. But I believe it was also, it would have come out as having a very different attitude about it. It would have been more, how should I put it, almost chiding people about not wanting to be this thing or not wanting to pursue or not being willing to do this hard work. And I recognized, you know, obviously more recently that that was certainly not an effective approach and it was not helpful. And that reflects definitely my continuing experiences just through my own life and my interactions with people and really recognizing that not only was there so much more to this idea generally, but there were very different ways to go about, you know, introducing it and communicating with people that would be far more effective and far more useful for them and valuable versus wagging my finger like a slightly disappointed father.
You know, I think you made a point early on that I really appreciate you saying when you tell us that just about everybody appreciates the quality of toughness and that we think of toughness in so many different respects. I mean, from the bouncer at the local bar that's willing to stand up to ruffians, to maybe our own stooped-over grandmother in her mid-90s, who nevertheless is, you know, making her way through life's challenges with pluck and determination. I mean, those are two examples of toughness that are vastly different from each other, and yet we really appreciate them. On some visceral level, we appreciate toughness, and we want it for ourselves. And yet, you tell us that we really tend to have a very vague notion about what toughness is. How about for you? At what point did you start to sort out what it really means to be tough or what the critical elements are in being tough in the best sense of the word?
Well, you know, to be honest, I've spent the last 41 years or so trying to put it all together and figure it out. Not entirely consciously that whole time, of course, but it's always been something that I've struggled to define and understand, but was compelled to seek out. And it's very difficult, of course, to pursue something that you don't entirely understand, right? It's like trying to find a location if you don't have it on a map. You just kind of drive around aimlessly. And I very much part of the problem is that we have so many different associations with the word. And the original publisher who offered me the deal for this book actually wanted to change the title because they felt it was so misleading. And of course, I was very obstinate about that. But it is, I believe we have to look at it in the sense that it is all-encompassing. In other words, it really involves every aspect of the way that we experience life in terms of our attitude, our perspective, the way we interact with other people, the way that we communicate with ourselves, you know, our inner monologue, which is often seems like more of a dialogue, really. And so that's why we have so many different ways of viewing it on top of, you know, the literary archetypes and what we see in movies and things like that and kind of the popular media sort of stuff, which is tends to be more towards the bouncer type versus, you know, the depression era survivor grandmother type. So it was certainly a process for me, and it took me a while to really dial it into a point where everything coalesced well enough for me to actually communicate it clearly. And part of that process was the actually writing itself. Is you know, having to communicate something to someone is one of the best ways, in my experience, to truly learn to understand it yourself.
Interesting. It is important to say that you bring to the table, in terms of your own personal toughness and your understanding of toughness, a wealth of life experience well beyond the athletic arena, but that is, of course, where all of this, in a sense, really started for you. I wonder if you could just say a quick word about the sport of weightlifting or powerlifting itself, in which you yourself was a nationally ranked competitor and for many years a highly regarded coach in the sport. Can you just say a quick word about the particular rigors of this particular sport and what you learned about toughness, both as yourself as a competitor in your own experiences and also in the experience of coaching all kinds of athletes in it?
Yeah, it's a really unique sport in a lot of ways. You know, of course, there's the obvious physical element of it, which is very demanding. It requires a ton of strength, but also a lot of mobility, you know, flexibility, balance, and speed. And we'd like to call it basically barbell gymnastics, you know, in a sense, because there's so much control and athleticism involved versus just plain old brute strength. And for people who don't know, it's lifting a barbell from the floor to overhead in two different lifts. And so this is the, you know, original sport with slight modifications from the first modern Olympics. It's been around a while. But where the toughness really comes in with this sport is that, number one, it's an individual sport. So unlike a team sport where you have a collection of teammates who can kind of back you up and help correct your errors throughout the course of an event, everything that happens is 100% your responsibility. And moreover, each action you take has really huge consequences because you have three opportunities to do each lift. So that's six total lifts in the competition. So you're looking at maybe, you know, 30 seconds of total competition time, which means that you are training, you know, 20 to 30 hours a week for months and years for 30 seconds to demonstrate what you're capable of. And so the mental aspect of the competition itself is enormous. You've got three judges, five jury, and a crowd watching you. You have that pressure, and you have the pressure of the preparation, which is really often very monotonous, very difficult, just soul-crushing work in the gym and out of the gym. You know, all the flexibility work, the rigid nutrition protocols, often cutting weight, you know, like wrestlers and fighters do. So you have all those things combined. I coached a woman for many years who had been an MVP collegiate softball pitcher with Berkeley. So she was on the national championship team at Berkeley. And she told me that weightlifting was so much more pressure in competition than she ever felt as a pitcher at that level, which to me was hard to believe. But that just kind of gives you a sense of what it feels like to be up there on that platform in that situation.
And again, I want to reiterate that your book is not just about how weightlifters and powerlifters can develop toughness, but really toughness inside and outside of the athletic arena. And it's probably also important for us to say that you describe yourself as someone who, in your early years, was, in your words, burdened with nearly crippling insecurity and self-consciousness. So you are not somebody for whom toughness has come naturally and easily and effortlessly throughout your life. You have had to learn about toughness, in a sense, from the ground up.
Yeah, and I think that's what has helped me understand and communicate the ideas. And I can draw a parallel with my coaching and weightlifting too, is I was not a naturally good weightlifter. I had to figure this stuff out, which is, I think, what allowed me to do so well working with other athletes, right? A very naturally talented athlete typically makes a terrible coach because they don't really understand how they're doing what they're doing, so they can't help other people figure it out. So having had the actual experiences, I think goes a long way in helping other people through that process. So yeah, I went from being a guy in 18, 19, 20 years old who would sometimes run out of food in my apartment because my anxiety of having to actually go out and interact with people would prevent me from going to the grocery store. I'm at the point now where very much of my life is public and available for criticism with my job. And I go and I can give 2-day-long seminars standing in front of a big crowd of people and talking by myself. So it's a huge transformation. It took many years, and it's certainly an ongoing thing. And that's a point I make repeatedly in the book, is that this isn't a quick change, right? You don't make a decision. You don't resolve to be tougher and then suddenly come Monday, you're good to go. It really is an ongoing process. But the good thing about that, rather than that being discouraging, is that means that, you know, every day you're working on this, you are achieving it, and you are, successful on some scale, no matter how small it is at that moment.
We're speaking with Greg Everett about his book, Tough: Building True Mental, Physical, and Emotional Toughness for Success and Fulfillment. The main framework of the book is, as you take us through what you regard as the 4 essential elements of toughness: character, who are you; capability, what are you able to do; capacity, what are you able to withstand; and finally, commitment, what are you willing to do? I have to say that, I mean, I read a lot of books in which there will be the 5 keys to achieving wealth, or the 10 ways to be a good neighbor, or whatever, and they often all start with the same letter, and sometimes that doesn't work so well, and one is obviously kind of reaching or stretching to kind of fulfill this formula. I have to say, I think you've come up with a very good framework here, and I don't think there would be 4 better words to describe the essential nature of toughness than these 4 words that all start with C: character, capability, capacity, and commitment. Briefly, talk us through these 4 elements and what is behind those perhaps deceptively simple terms.
Yeah, the key with them working was that it was not my intention to make them alliteration, but it just works out that way.
Right.
Character is our understanding of our identity, who we truly are. And beyond that, it is not simply learning who we are. It is determining who we are, right? It is deciding, who do I want to be? And now what are the steps I have to take to actually, create, reinforce, and consistently perform the behavior and the ways of thinking and responding to things that actually support that identity. And then the corollary there is that we have to be secure in that identity, right? Because that insecurity in who we are is what puts us in positions of, seeking approval and validation inappropriately and silly competition among ourselves, the one-upmanship sort of thing. And so without that knowledge of who we are and what we value, what's important to us, we cannot seek the things that will fulfill us and make us happy. We cannot be the kind of people who have, you know, quality relationships and are able to contribute to the rest of the world. We're so focused on being unhappy and discontent that we can't really get anywhere. Capability is really broad too, and because it is encompassing physical traits and characteristics. So, you know, more athletic sort of things. What are you physically able to do? We want to have as broad a range of possibilities there. And then also it encompasses our knowledge and our skills in terms of, you know, intellectual things. And that includes, you know, everything from your standard kind of book knowledge, but also your experiences in life, right? What have you done? And because the experiences we have is where we really gain insight. That's the material for all of our rumination that eventually leads to understanding. We can read things in a book, but that's very different from getting out into life, putting ourselves in uncomfortable situations in order to actually learn something new and exposing ourselves to experiences outside of our very typically narrow bandwidth of comfort, right? We all have specialties and areas that we're comfortable in, we're familiar with, and it's easy for us to overestimate what we know and what we're capable of outside of that without having that experience. Capacity is what a lot of us think of as resilience, but to me, resilience is a starting point. Resilience means that you're able to return to your original condition following some kind of, you know, trauma. And that's a good start, obviously, because we're not being damaged by that trauma. But what I'm looking for is more what we call like work hardening. I want to end up at the other end of some adverse experience or challenge better than I was before going into it. So that means we're going to take that adversity and force it to become an opportunity for us to learn, to get stronger, to get, to gain those experiences, to have the new perspectives, to apply that to future experiences. And so every time we go through something difficult, that means we are better and better prepared for future unpredictable, undesirable experiences. And then finally, the commitment side of things, this includes all the typical, you know, discipline and habit forming and routines and all that, but it's really more of an attitude about being actually willing to put all these things into play when it's important, right? So it's one thing to know, this is who I am, this is who I believe I am, this is what's important to me. But when that's challenged and we back away from that, that's a lack of commitment, right? We're not truly committed to that character. Or if we have all this amazing capability and capacity, but then something difficult occurs, and we decide, I'm going to let it, you know, happen, and I'm not going to bother doing anything about it. Well, none of that stuff is meaningful now. So that without that commitment side, all these other things are just kind of this private fantasy that we play out in our own minds to prop up our own egos, rather than actually being that person and putting those things to good use.
I do appreciate the thought that you have put together in all of this, and I especially appreciated when you talked about that third element of capacity. What are you able to withstand? That you go beyond what we so often think of as the ability to cope with stress, adversity, danger. You say also our ability to cope with the unpredictable. And I not stop to think about that, but I think for people for whom resiliency is an issue, it's often those sorts of moments of kind of the unpredictable mishaps that befall us that are all but inescapable in life that in which they will just be left undone and unable to cope. And I really appreciate the fact that you include that in your thoughts about fostering this characteristic.
Yeah, it's important because you look at so much of the source of difficulty in an adverse situation is based on its unpredictability, right? If it was predictable, we knew it was coming, that means we're able to prepare mentally, emotionally, and physically. And consequently, it's not going to be anywhere near as difficult. If something befalls you out of the blue, really abruptly, then all of a sudden you are left having to deal with it without any of that preparation, without psyching yourself up and getting ready and making plans and preparation. You have to already have that mindset and those capabilities and that willingness in place. And so that's kind of the point here, is that we want to develop that stuff before we need it, rather than finding ourselves in this horrible situation and recognizing, hey, I don't have the tools, I don't have the mental and emotional skills to deal with this productively, and so now I'm going to fall apart and it's going to take me 10 years, to kind of get back to my baseline. And, of course, the important thing to understand is having these qualities doesn't mean that unpleasant experiences are magically pleasant now, right? Adversity is still adversity. Challenges are still challenges. But when we change our mindset about it, we have a different attitude about it, they are less unpleasant in the sense that we can see a purpose to them. We can see meaning behind them. We can see, at least in the long run, some kind of benefit from them, rather than feeling like victims who the universe is just burdening with these horrible experiences, and now we have to just kind of go wallow in our misery forever.
Right. I think you're very smart to anticipate certain concerns that a reader might have as they make their way through your book, and one of them involves the whole matter of emotions. You are very careful to say toughness in no way demands emotional sterility. In other words, being tough does not mean making yourself a less emotional person, or by tamping down your emotions or sort of driving them out of your life. I mean, you acknowledge that emotions are important for who we are, but it's really important that we develop the capacity to not allow our emotions to rule the decisions that we make, especially in a way that can be ultimately really counterproductive and sometimes even self-destructive.
Right. And, the stiff upper lip philosophy, kind of, like you said, just tamping these things down and pretending they don't exist, in a practical sense might work temporarily, but in the long term, it just leads to so many problems. And you're also robbing yourself of the thing that really provides the texture to our lives, right? And I make the point in the book that the experiences that we enjoy, the things that we seek out, we do so because of the way they make us feel, right? So we can say, well, what's meaningful to you? Well, my family, or, climbing mountains. Okay, that's great. That's the concrete part of it. But why are those things important? And the fact is, they're important because they make us feel a certain way that we enjoy. So emotion is critical to our experience as human beings. But, rational thought, reason, is equally critical. That's why we're blessed with both of those faculties. The issue is not getting rid of one or the other, or making one dominant over the other necessarily, but it's learning how to use them properly. And so you want to be able to experience an emotion genuinely, like really understand or really feel what it is, and in the appropriate times, and get everything you can out of it, without allowing that to unduly influence the course of your life, or your really important decisions that then create problems for you in the short or long term. So it's really just a balance of it. And it's never a perfect, you can't say, well, it's 50% emotion and 50% reason. It is totally condition specific. And it's more of a constant interplay between the two. And that is how it's supposed to function. But we've gotten to a point where we really collectively don't understand the role these things play. And some of us will think, well, the rational mind is so calculating and it's so inhuman. Well, no, it's not inhuman. It's an inherent part of human beings. So, that is part of what makes us human. But being unemotional is inhuman, right? Because that is a part of our inherent capabilities, and that is, we need to use that to our advantage. So it's really being honest with yourself and being willing to take a look at what you're feeling, understand it, experience it, and then still be able to make rational decisions and wise choices when it comes to what you are actually doing, saying, and thinking, versus just allowing yourself to be consumed with these secondary emotions, which are often really terrible arbiters of, you know, our decisions, right? We can see that play out in any number of ways in people's lives.
Absolutely. You say our emotions often are the most seductive and influential voices that we listen to. I appreciate that your book disavows us of the notion that to be tough means being masculine. And you say we need to distinguish toughness from sex and gender and wipe away the odd social coloring that it has been painted with. I want to give you a moment or so to just touch on another important matter, that of aggression and violence. You say toughness does not mean picking fights. In your words, we don't swing a sledgehammer at every problem we encounter simply because we possess the strength and have one handy. And this is probably the single most significant point of clarification you offer in the whole book, in my opinion, is that that when we are talking about someone who is tough, it does not mean any of these other things that that of course can be so destructive to oneself and others. Just say a quick word about this distinction. I think it's crucial.
Yeah, and that's an unfortunate thing that so many people associate with toughness, is that it's violent and aggressive, and, you know, even to the point of misogyny for many people. So there's so much really negative connotation with the term because it's been so misrepresented and confused. But there's a very big difference between being capable of violence, being willing to engage in violence for specific purposes in very specific circumstances, i.e. when there is no other option in order to protect yourself or protect your loved ones or people for whom you're responsible. That is, you know, our personal decision to make whether we're willing to engage in violence in those situations and to what degree. You know, each of us has that choice to make. But where toughness comes in is our willingness to, you know, commit to performing the actions that we believe are necessary and warranted in any given situation. So, in other words, if we decide that we are willing to engage in violence up to whatever level, you know, including killing someone to protect, say, our child, that means that in that situation, when there is no other choice, we are willing to do that. And it means that if we've decided, I will never cause another human being harm, that means being willing to commit to that belief and being willing to sacrifice your life or someone else's life in order to live up to that. So that's really what it is the willingness and the commitment and the true understanding of what is significant to you, what is meaningful to you, and what you're willing to do, not, you know, this other very specific route, which is, if there's any problem, I'm just going to punch him in the face. Mm. You know, those are very different attitudes, and the latter tends to be quite the opposite of toughness. That tends to be the result of insecurity and fear of exposure, and that's the classic bullying persona, right? It's an overreaction to that insecurity and that self-consciousness and that worry that you're going to be exposed as being vulnerable and weak.
Hmm. That and many other wonderful moments of deep reflection and thoughtfulness are found in this book, again, which is titled Tough: Building True Mental, Physical, and Emotional Toughness for Success and Fulfillment. And its author, Greg Everett. Greg Everett, thank you so much for writing such an intriguing and thought-provoking book. And thank you for being part of the morning show today. I really enjoyed talking with you. Best wishes.
Thank you very much.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin, Parkside, offering a new online sports management master's degree. Learn business skills for today's fast-paced sports environment. Details online at uwp.edu. approaching 9 o'clock on this Wednesday, February 17th. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. Coming up at 9:01, we'll join NPR for the news, and then we join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming through the morning. And then I am back at noon with the